anyone who has question, you know, this is a good opportunity to ask Venerable Longpo Ajahn Jasaro. Please, you know, mention your name first and then your question.
My name is Venerable Kim Ajara. I'm also a student here. I'm now studying MA 2 years. So I would like to ask the most Venerable is that in your techniques, meditation techniques, can you please explain more about how to discern the reality, just to discern Vaikuntha, and how to upgrade to Vipassana insight meditation?
Well, the Buddha taught very, very clearly that any kind of meditation technique must be aimed at taking the mind beyond the five hindrances. So whether it's a technique based which includes the use of the thinking mind and reflection, say the Anusati meditations, or a meditation based upon observation of physical processes, one which you're not using the discursive mind at all, the unifying point is that they should take the mind beyond the five hindrances. So as long as there are hindrances in the mind, then there's no samadhi. And if there's no samadhi, then there's no yathābhūta yāna dasana, there's no seeing things according to truth. So this is our challenge, how to take the mind beyond the five hindrances. Sometimes then can see that the mind's really ready for meditation. The moment you sit on your seat, you know, you feel you're really ready and enthusiastic and committed. But there are also times, even for bhikkhus, where, you know, you just sit there because it's the time to sit, or you're lacking some real sincere motivation. And I think this is a really very important point, that meditation will only really develop when you have chanda, when you have kusala chanda, dhamma chanda in the mind. And this is your first question when you sit down: is there dhamma chanda in my mind? And you have to be very, very honest with yourself. And if there's not dhamma chanda, then you need to stimulate dhamma chanda, and you should have a number of different skillful means to do that. You see what works for you. So it might be recollecting the virtues of the Buddha, or stories from the Buddha's life, or of the great arahants at the time of the Buddha, or particular Dhamma teachings that inspire you, or recalling the great masters, the great arahants of the past or of the present day, anything which will just bring up this sense of inspiration and energy. So, you know, it's usually we're looking for inspiration from our teachers and from surroundings. But this is a very important skill that we need to how to inspire yourself, how to motivate yourself, drawing upon your study. This is one of the values of Bariyati. It's giving you a fund, that you've got this whole resource or database of inspiring materials that you can bring to your mind. And in order to create the necessary supporting conditions for development of meditation. So I think that myself, having spoken to so many meditators over such a long period of time, I'm not convinced that there's any one technique that's better than any other technique, but it's more the attitude with which you apply the technique that you've chosen. And being a little bit flexible, a little bit creative. And so this is when you sit down, you know, this is my raw materials today, right now. This is what I've got to work with right now. So what's the most skillful way of working with this? It's not like how you'd like it to be, or you think it should be like this, or yesterday it was so good, why is it like this today, you know, and then get caught up in doubts. But this is how it is right now. It's like this. So what's my best way forward, given what it's like? So is this the hindrances? They're like a kind of a spectrum. So you have very coarse expression of a hindrance, and then going all the way to very quite refined or subtle levels of hindrance. And so as monastics often, like the third hindrance of sloth, torpor, dullness of mind. That's a big one for monks, isn't it? And the thing to be aware of is that, you know, the quality of the mind which is developing samadhi is this word gamaniyo. It's that like pliability, flexibility of mind. One teacher compared it to like copper wire. You know, like copper wire, you can bend it, it's very strong, but you can bend it this way and bend it that way. So if you're meditating and you not a lot of thoughts in your mind, you feel quite solid and good, but you have that kind of stiffness, that kind of rigid quality in your mind. That's the tini mita, the third hindrance, and the more subtle, and that's the one that many people get caught in, this kind of subtle stiffness of mind. So each of those hindrances, so, you know, you deal with the coarser, and then you go on to refine. But if you look on it as an exploration and a learning process, rather than I got to do this in order to get that, but you say like that, this is like I'm learning about the mind, I'm learning about the human mind, I'm learning about how to deal with the challenges. So even if you have a so-called bad meditation, you know, you can learn a lot from what's called bad meditations or difficult meditations. So it's that skill of how to look at it, how you framing your practice. Yes.
Good evening, Prachan. My name is Sangamita. I'm from Malaysia. I'm an MA first year student here in SSBU. I would like to ask, we have a Sangha community that some stay in the forest and some in the city. So what is the pros and cons living style, like monastic life in the forest and in the city? And what would Prachan advise to us, like for those Sangha members that stay in the city, they might be very busy with the duty and with the services to the society. How about the practice? Maybe you, Prachan, can advise in daily routine how they could keep the practice with a busy life. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm a little bit biased, of course, as a forest monk, but I feel like, you know, just as a natural habitat of a bird is the sky and a fish is the sea, natural habitat of a bhikkhu is the forest with the nature. But I'm also reminded of the sutta in which the Buddha was talking about the future of Buddha Sasana, and he said as long as bhikkhus take delight in forest life, the Buddha Sasana will not disappear from the world. So the Buddha obviously gave it a lot of support, a lot of importance. But nevertheless, I mean, I've often, you know, when I first came to Thailand, I was a very idealistic young man, and I could not help but be critical of many of the monks I saw in the cities and the towns, the very lax attitude towards the vinaya, and living lives were not very not in harmony, not as I thought monks should be living. But of course, after many years and understanding, I hope things are much better, my view changed, and I believe now that without the monks in the towns and the cities and the villages, then Buddhism may well have disappeared from Thailand or even Burma by now. That, or else it would be a bit like Zen Buddhism in Japan. Presently, it's very like elite, just a very small number of monks, and with a very little influence on the society at large. So the closer relationship between the monastics who are living in villages and towns and cities and having daily contact with the lay people and being able to advise and teach and perform ceremonies, and the big picture of Theravada Buddhism in Southeast Asia, that's absolutely invaluable. Nevertheless, I think that there are a lot of problems and there's a lot of corruption involved, and particularly around money, because for hundreds of years, it didn't really matter that the monks in the villages and towns and cities handled money, because nobody had any money. The lay people had no money. Monks would just have a very small amount of money just to buy most important requisites. But then as society changed and the people became much wealthier, then they wanted to share their wealth with the Sangha, and monks who were not keeping the precept about refraining from use of money found getting wealthy, and a lot of competition and rivalry and bad feeling and all kinds of excesses started to appear. So it's not so much living in the city and living in the town as the vinaya, because the vinaya and the precepts are what protect you. And my teacher said, you look after the precepts, the precepts will look after you. So if you are living in a more busy environment, then it's even more important that you have very good standards of vinaya to protect you, because the environment is not so protective as it is in the forest. I think that it's wonderful that there are monastics willing to make sacrifices and to be teaching lay people. But in my tradition, at least we say that at least for the first 5 years of monastic life, your ambition should be to be nobody. You know, there'll be plenty of time to be somebody in the Buddhist world when you get more senior. But one of the great luxuries and one of the great most valuable things is to spend years where nobody knows who you are and where you don't have any expectations and any responsibilities towards larger Buddhist community. And when you develop that inner strength and inner maturity and knowledge and so on, then as you get more, then you can choose how to live your life in a way which is most fulfilling for yourself and for others. Even though you are perhaps living in a monastery or temple in the city, then it's still, I think, important to be taking periods of retreat. So having times of the year where you don't teach or you don't have activities, and let that be known within the community, So that might be for 3 months of the annual rains retreat, or in the Western monasteries where that 3 month period coincides with the summer, they shift their 3 month period to the beginning of the year in the winter. But the idea, I think, is a sound one, to have a period of time where you're just putting your emphasis and your efforts into your own practice in order to be able to carry on your duties and your service to others at other times without becoming overwhelmed.
Good evening. My name is Branko. I'm coming from Serbia, and I'm a student here. I'm a student first year. So I have a question which relates to monks, although I'm not a monk, but somehow I'm struggling with this question, how to answer. And I would like to start with the fact that I think you can agree with this, that this world is burdened with so many challenges we have. And the last one is this coronavirus, but also socially, this disparity of the wealth, where the 1% of the population owns the 50% of the social wealth, and corruption and all you mentioned. So somehow I would like to explain how you see the role of monk, whether because the as far as I see, there is kind of or contradiction in the role of the monk. Monk should be in the forest meditating, kind of introvert. But somehow I think that monks also should have a say or role in the wider society. So in your personal example or in general, how monks can balance these two poles or these two roles that they have, working on themselves, but also working for the betterment of the society. Because I really deeply believe that if something can help to improve the situation, this is this kind of spiritual work, not material work. You mentioned all these agencies which are engaged in healing kind of immediate threats, but in the long run, deeply, we need to all, whether monks or lay people, to transform spiritually. And then, because all these problems are just reflection of our mind, which is ankilesas. So thank you so much.
Yeah. I would say, first of all, if you were to hear about in the Amazon jungle, there are still patches of the Amazon jungle which are completely unexplored, unreached, and in the middle there are these huge trees, majestic trees, some of the most beautiful and wonderful trees in the world. And even though you probably in your lifetime you won't ever see those trees or have anything to do with trees or even see photographs of these trees, it just feels really good to know that there are those trees there in the middle of the jungle. And I think knowing that there are monks practicing alone or nuns and people who are practicing and realizing fruits of the holy life, even if they're not playing any tangible role in making the world a better place, as it were, that's a wonderful thing. But that's just sort of one extreme example. I think that the monks have many different, and so including nuns in this and monastics. One is that there's the integrity and the quality of sila and knowing and seeing people who are practicing what they're preaching and trying to live by their ideals and living by a very high standard of sila. And, you know, to have groups of young men living together, whether it's 40, 50, I mean, there are monasteries with hundreds of monks, and that you could have a group of young men in their 20s and 30s and can live together in that kind of harmony and goodwill and kindness and care. I think that's an incredible lesson to the world, something. So I often encouraging young monks, you just living your life as a monk, you know, it's really, people see it and they're uplifted by it. And we, in the my tradition, we built a number of monasteries in Western countries, and it was a question about how much of this tradition could be transplanted into non-Buddhist environment. And there are a lot of different views about it, of course. And my teacher, Ajahn Chah, just said, well, try and do everything the same way that you do it in Thailand, and then see what works and what doesn't work. Don't you have to decide beforehand. And in fact, we found that we could practice almost exactly the same way, just some minor changes in clothing and wearing like long sleeve anksas, shirts and things like this. But one aspect of the forest monk's life that nobody thought would be possible to transplant into the West is what we call tudong, or just like in Thailand and in Burma, I don't know, I suppose, just the monks just set off and walking through the forest and walking through the countryside, and then in the morning walk into village for alms food. And we thought, how would that ever work in a non-Buddhist country, you know, where people are not Buddhists, and they see strange, bald-headed, robed figures walking through the town, you know, who's going to give them anything to eat? And it's been absolutely incredible. We've had monks walking through from California up to Washington State, 2,000-kilometer walk, 2-3 months, only 2 days when they never got fed. Monks walking through Germany, France, England, Ireland, Italy, all over, and everywhere they go, people see monks, see people dressed this way. They're not Buddhists, don't have any, often any, and just something about the form, something about what we're doing, it just inspires people. They want to offer support. Often people will come up to you and say, give you money, and then you say, I can't take money. They say, what are you doing? I mean, is it even more inspired? You know, so what, somebody doesn't want money, and then you say, only food, and then people say, well, just stay there, don't do anything. I just go in the shop and buy you something. So I have a lot of faith. This form is something which somehow it encourages goodness in people. Mm. On more tangible level, monks do a lot of teaching in schools, and I mean, you just see what, and all the things that Venerable Ajahn Kammai yesterday, he was in a big prison in Yangon and teaches in universities, and is a wonderful reputation in England already after just a few years. This whole place, you just see that someone who applies himself to bhikkhu life with integrity and intelligence and faith, just how much goodness that they can bring into one place. And it's like a magnet, this form is like a magnet for goodness, I think. I myself lead reasonably secluded life, but I have this all these people around me, this group who come and they do all these, so I'm kind of just kind of lazy fellow really, but I got all these very diligent people who record what I'm doing, and they put it on YouTube, and they put it on podcasts, and they so. For me, technology, rather than being a distraction, as it can be for many monks, means that I can just live my life quietly and or visiting here, and then that's, you know, it's broadcast around the world, and so can feel that I am contributing some way to propagating Buddhist principles. And of course, many monks are also writing books, and there are so many ways of sharing the Dhamma these days that weren't available before. Larger level, social level, the idea of Sangha is of a unifying force or body in the society. So when you have a lot of different political groups, right wing, left wing, rich, poor, etc., etc. The idea of the Sangha is that it's completely non-partisan, and whoever you are, the moment you enter the gates of the monastery, now you're just a Buddhist layman or a Buddhist laywoman. And ideally, the Sangha, the abbot, teaches. Treats everybody equally. There's no special privileges for rich, wealthy donors. Everyone's treated with kindness and compassion. And often you find people coming together and chanting together and listening to Dhamma together, eating together in monasteries, who would never, you know, have met in that way. And there is this sense of you know, we're all Buddhists together, and I think that monasteries provide that function in society. So it's so important that the monks don't become identified with any particular political party or political program. But what monks can say, without mentioning politicians or political programs or parties, we talk about the five precepts, and they say, well, this is in conflict with the five precepts. This is in conflict with the Buddha's teachings. This is so. It's giving the Buddhist perspective on things, and being an organization which everybody recognizes doesn't have an axe to grind, doesn't have any kind of political programs or objectives. It's not beholden to anybody. And I think that's a role that the Sangha can and should be able to play. It's more complicated in countries like Burma, Myanmar, and Sri Lanka because of the colonial history. It's clearer in Thailand. Thailand, fortunate enough, never to be colonized, and so the relationship between the monarchy and the Sangha and the independent and neutral role of the Sangha has been maintained quite well, I think, big picture. Whereas in Sri Lanka, Myanmar, then the effort to drive out the colonial masters, the British, meant that the Sangha, because most of the elite, the really smart people, were going to the Sangha. And so when the society's in turmoil, and who does it turn to? It turns to the monks. And so in Sri Lanka and Myanmar, the bhikkhus have had more of a overt political role because of the history. But still the ideal is to be that neutral refuge for everyone, irrespective of their social and political backgrounds. So can I ask the bhikkhus who got exams, are you stressed out? Are you handling it? I wish you all success in your exams tomorrow.
Ask one question, one very simple question. You have recounted a bit about your life in the Dhamma. And you have written some wonderful books, one for the hotel, and I don't think we have got enough of those we have seen. Many enough people have seen that book in this country. And also your more well-known book, you know, Stillness Flowing, which we have in our library. We have both of them. For the sake of our student here, as for my own interest, I'm not sure if you have gone through a formal study of the sutta and all those, examination sometimes over a sense of exam in this process. But, you know, clearly, reading your books, you know, you are very learned, Thera, Mahathera, and would you like to share, you know, how you study the Tripitaka?
How I study?
The Tripitaka. The scriptures.
Yeah, I'm very unsystematic in my studies. I've whether it's studies of Thai language or my studies of the Pariyatti Dhamma, studies of Tripitaka, not anything really to hold up as an example to anybody else. I mean, I love the suttas. This is the main thing. And I've been fortunate enough to have been offered copies of the Bhikkhu Bodhi's translations and others. So I have an extensive bookshelf and library. And I spend periods where I pick up the Anguttara and look at the Anguttara for a couple of weeks, or I pick up the Majjhima and go back to the Majjhima. Majjhima was the first of the Bhikkhu Bodhi translations that I received many years ago now, and that's a treasure. Plus, I have been the monk other than Ajahn Chah, the monk that I look up to and revere the most, and I've had fortunate enough to have quite a close relationship now with 4 of 30 years, is Somdet Puttagosajan P.A. Payuto, and his works have been a great inspiration to me. He's someone who's extremely, I think, of Thai scholars, he's one, you can say, definitely top level. And it's not just that his knowledge of Sutta and Atikata and all the Tripitaka is so extensive, but for me, his genius is that he's able to take the teachings out of particular contexts and apply them to the problems of the modern world. You know, where exactly in the Tripitaka do we find teachings that we can respond to the climate crisis or economic development and its pitfalls, or education system? And so for me, this is often the weakness of the scholarly approach, is it's too much confined to the curriculums and to the particular form of the monastic education, whereas he's not like he's just consumed these, but he's fully digested them, and he's able to take from here and take from here and take from there, and to apply these things. And so I've learned a great deal from him and his scholarship, and I certainly look to him as my teacher.
If no one has any more questions now, as a form of gratitude and show our respect, we say sadhu three times together. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.